Yes, we'll have to put off discussion of the gold standard until another time. What I want to concentrate on this morning is something that we all learned from Murray Rothbard in his work on the origin of the Federal Reserve, where he showed that Federal Reserve policy is driven actually by politics. It's driven by the interest of the federal government and the interest of the banking elite. And because of this, it would have been and was in historically opposed, right, by the general public, which required this apparatus of economists, professional economists, to provide something like a scientific veneer to a mask, right, to cover what was actually being done to generate sufficient public acceptance of the monster that we call the Federal Reserve. So I would like to discuss in my talk then the most recent attempt by professional economists to provide this sort of veneer, this scientific veneer that covers over Fed policy that is still, as we know and have experienced since the financial crisis of 2007, driven by politics. It's driven by the interest of the federal government and the banking elite. And this is embodied in this hunt for the neutral rate of interest. And this is monetary policy in accordance with the Taylor Rule. And you can see the equation for the Taylor Rule on the slide and the meaning of the symbols. So the little I is the target rate for the federal funds rate that the Fed sets, right? R star is the neutral rate of interest, which we'll get to here in a minute. The sign for pi is the price inflation rate. Pi star is the target that the Fed has for the rate of inflation, the 2% inflation target. Y refers to real output, and Y star is potential real output, what the economy would produce if it were at full employment. And you can see that this this policy equation, or this policy model, if you will, if the Fed were to meet its dual mandate and create the perfect balance between stable prices, which is 2% price inflation, and full employment production, then the two parenthetical figures in the equation would, of course, be zero, which means that their target would be equal to the neutral rate of interest, R star, adjusted for price inflation. So you can see how crucial the neutral rate of interest, getting an estimate of the neutral rate of interest, is to the science, allegedly, that they're doing when they come up with the target for the Fed funds rate. Now, where does this idea come from? Well, this idea comes from, the idea of the neutral rate comes from Wicksell. And this is what Wicksell wrote in his book, Interest and Prices. There's a certain rate of interest on loans which is neutral in respect to commodity prices and tends neither to raise nor lower them. This is necessarily the same rate of interest which would be determined by supply and demand if no use were made of money and all lending were effected in the form of real capital goods. It comes to much the same thing to describe it as the current value of the natural rate of interest on capital. So you can see this is a rather odd concept, right? He's saying that if loans were in the real physical things, the capital goods, then we would see manifested in those rates this neutral or natural rate of interest. And his idea was the connection that he made between this neutral rate and the price level was the idea that if the bank interest rate, which is in money, would differ from this neutral rate, which is in real goods, then you would see movements in the purchasing power of money. So, for example, If the bank interest rate were lower than the rate of return that investors could get in investing in capital, then entrepreneurs would rush to the banks to borrow at the lower rate and then invest in the higher natural rate in the market. And as they did this, the banks would respond by just lending more. They would just create credit and lend more in excess of the pool of saving that people provided with their time preference. And this would set in motion the boom. And the boom would set in motion higher prices. And then the banks would adjust to that by raising the bank rate. And so we'd move back to this equilibrium. And the opposite would happen if the bank, if banks set the bank rate, their monetary rate, above the rate of return on real goods, then entrepreneurs would not borrow, right? They'd withdraw their borrowing, and then this would lead to a bust, and then the price structure would fall, and you'd see with price deflation, the bank would adjust its interest rate, and then things would return to sort of normal. And we can see, because we all are cognizant of Mises's Austrian business cycle theory, we can see that Wicksell's analysis here is one of the threads that Mises took to weave together his business cycle theory. But of course, it's his is much more realistic, where he didn't think that what we're looking at, or what we should look at, is something like an interest return on physical goods, right? So since all things trade for and against money, you can have an interest return on investment in capital structure, and you can have interest returns on credit loans. But because investors will arbitrage between any difference between these two rates, right, they're connected, and so they tend to move up and down together. And this is where Mises points out that if the banks then lower the bank interest rate through credit expansion, this will lower the rate of return on investment in real capital goods and set in motion the boom, which is unsustainable, and then comes to an end. So Mises also pointed out that in a market economy, independent banks will not be able to push any increase in fiduciary media very far. And so there's a kind of natural restriction of any dislocations in production that would occur in a market economy. In other words, we don't need monetary policy to give us the correct interest rate. This just would naturally arise through market exchange. The interest rate would conform to people's time preferences. So that was one path that was taken in economics from Wicksell's work. The other path, the path that we want to look at, was developed by Keynes. And what Keynes did was he accepted Wicksell's position that the interest rate is always adjusting to keep the amount of money borrowed for investment equal to the amount of money that's being saved. So he accepted that particular point. But as the Keynesians would have it, if you think about the textbook ISLM framework for Keynesianism, what Keynes was arguing was that the interest rate will be inversely related to investment. Again, along Wicksell's line, right? If the interest rate is high, then entrepreneurs will not borrow very much or invest very much. And so aggregate demand will be lower. And so income will be lower. And if income's lower, saving will be lower. And they'll equate again at this under full employment equilibrium. So this was this is how Keynes took this. Now, given that, what's happened in the current situation is the insertion of this notion of what, again, is called the neutral rate of interest. And I know on the slide it says natural rate of interest, but for my talk, I'm going to use just the term neutral rate of interest for the targeting, even though some of the slides still say natural. I couldn't correct that on the slide. Oh well. So you could see their thinking, right? So the Keynesian approach to this would say any point along the IS curve that correlates real interest rates with output GDP would be a Wicksellian investment is equal to saving point. And the banks could, if it were just left to the banks, they could set any interest rate along the IS curve. And you might end up then with a less than full employment or less than potential GDP outcome. So it's up to the Federal Reserve to set the neutral rate of interest, or on the diagram, the natural rate of interest, at the right spot so that it hits the IS curve at this estimate of what potential GDP happens to be. So now the next question is, well, potential GDP is not observable. Neither is the neutral rate of interest. These are not, you can't get empirical data on these concepts, right? So what do we do? Well, this is a quote from two Fed economists who work in this field, Laubach and Williams. And what they said in their 2016 article is, we operationalize this notion, that is, of the neutral rate, by defining the neutral rate as the real short-term interest rate consistent with the economy operating at its full potential once transitory shocks to aggregate supply and demand have abated. So they've got this more dynamic notion that you've got a trend of potential GDP over time, and then you've got this cyclical variation, you know, booms and busts that move around the trend. And they're trying to parse this out by locating where, you know, full employment output trends happen to go. So the next step is, well, how then do they actually operationalize this? What kind of a model do they have to give us an estimate of potential GDP? And the way in which they do this is they construct first a very simple model. It's just a straight linear association between the neutral rate of interest and potential GDP, just like in the previous slide, right? They want to estimate potential GDP, and then they'll know what the interest rate is along the IS curve. They just estimate these things, right, with their model. And the model has a parameter value that they adapt in order to take into account their actual estimates of real data, and then a stochastic variable, which gives them the variability that they can't predict over the cycle. So it's a very simple arrangement. It's just kind of a correspondence directly between the neutral rate and potential GDP, again, just as we looked at in the last slide. Now, here's the technical part. The technical part is, how do they estimate potential GDP? Right? That's the difficult thing, right? And they do this in using what's called a Kalman filter. And to give you a simple example of how a Kalman filter works, it's something like this. Suppose we have an enemy group that's shooting missiles into our territory, and we have an anti-ballistic missile system that tries to shoot them down in flight. A Kalman filter will do the following in a scenario like that. The missile is shot. You have a pinpoint radar that hits the missile and gives you an exact location. And then you do this again as the missile's moving. You hit it again. And now you can calculate its velocity, right? And then you just continue to do this, you know, over time, and you get a predictive trend line. You can see, like, potential GDP. You get a trend line, and then in the next iteration, you don't predict it. You shoot your anti-ballistic missile, and you hope to hit it, right? Because you've estimated where that missile that's incoming will actually be located exactly in space. So this is the idea of a Kalman filter. Now, as I pointed out, hopefully emphasized sufficiently, the Kalman filter process seems to me to be completely inapplicable in this case of potential GDP, because the only thing that you can actually measure in GDP is real GDP. The only data you have is the actual GDP, right? You don't know what potential GDP is. And so there are all these processes that Laubach and Williams try to use in order to come up with an estimate of potential GDP. But you see, this is completely unlike the Kalman filter use in real objects that are moving in space-time, where you're actually measuring the thing that you're trying to predict. Yeah, okay. So this is what Laubach and Williams came up with. This, again, is just a chart of the estimates that they made in their 2016 article. And you can see the red line is the standard model. This is their simple model that they used to do the estimate. And again, this is the estimate of the neutral rate of interest that the Fed then should target if they're hitting perfectly their dual mandate, right, as we showed in the beginning. And then there's an alternative. The green is the alternative long-run estimate of R star, the neutral rate of interest, where it's more smoothed out, right? And you could see the long-term trajectory then that your policy is aiming to hit. And then you can see the blue line is the short run. So the short run has this tremendous variation because of the cyclical movement of price inflation rates and real GDP movements, right? They go up and down over the cycle and so on. And that's all smoothed out in these alternatives, the red and the green estimates. So that's one way in which the estimates are made. Now, another way to make estimates that's common in the literature, another allegedly scientific way to do these estimates, is to just forget modeling altogether. And what you do in this approach, called time-varying parameter vector autoregression estimates, you can see how the mask goes on, right, in the economists. Here you just simply, regress, you take a regression estimate of lagged values of the same data that you're trying to estimate, right? So you have a path of real GDP, and you just predict the next one by looking at lagged estimates of where it's gone. There's no modeling here at all. It's purely empirical. And then you do this, in this particular case, you have to do this with real GDP, with rates of price inflation, and with real interest rates. So these are the three variables that you track in this process. And when you do this, you come up with this estimate. So this estimate is the dark line in the middle. That's the estimate using the TVP VAR technique. And you can see it at first in the data set, but when you run back to the 60s and 70s, it doesn't track very well with the LW estimate. But then it starts to track pretty good once you get into the mid-80s. They tend to run pretty close together, right? Now, the interesting thing about this is actually the lighter lines above and below. Those lighter lines are the 90% confidence interval for the estimate. Wow. So is this science? I don't know. How confident are we that we're coming in this, you know, average that we get between these rather large confidence intervals that don't tend to sort of shrink over time, right? They seem pretty constant. This seems more like human judgment to me than science. Now, the reason for the confidence intervals being so large is this is what the light green is the actual ex ante real interest rate. That's how much it moves over time. And again, the red is just the original LW estimate of the neutral rate, which is, what exactly are we, how exactly accurate is this? Are we really going to set rates, you know, according to the red line, hoping that this is sort of going to work out? It doesn't seem, again, so much like science. Now, let me deal with one other. So I've dealt with one criticism of this LW approach. Let me deal with the other one, which has to do with the data itself. So remember, the first criticism is the Kalman filter approach to the neutral rate of interest doesn't actually use real data. It's trying to estimate something that we don't know, that we're using the model to estimate. So it's not even like the missile case, measuring the actual position of the missile as it moves through space-time, right? So how applicable is the Kalman filter technique? But the other problem has to do with the data itself, right? How good is the data that we have in measuring potential output? How good is the data that we have in real GDP? We know, again, all the way back to Mises's book on the theory of money and credit, we know that there is no such thing as a scientific price index. So this was one of the important arguments that Mises made in the book. We can come up with all sorts of different configurations of goods to put in our price index measure, and in no case can we say that one of these is objectively correct and another is objectively wrong, right? So we have all sorts of options. We have the CPI, we have the PCE, we've got the core versions of these, right? In Laubach and Williams, they use the PCE and then they take out fuel and food, or, you know, it's all okay. So again, how scientific is this? And the price index is used not only for the measure of price inflation, but for the calculation of real GDP. We have the same issue with GDP. GDP is not the only measure of output. Mark Skousen touts the gross output measure, right? That's a legitimate measure of output. Murray Rothbard gave us the private product remaining measure of output. Why should we lump in government expenditures with private expenditure? It's apples and oranges, isn't it, that we're putting together, since there's no economic calculation involved in government expenditures that we're lumping in? Is that really relevant to Fed policy that's supposed to be giving us this perfect dual mandate world of, you know, stable prices and full employment? What about employment? As Ryan McMakin has shown us over and over again, the unemployment and employment figures are really accurate. They're being revised, you know, every couple months, and almost always downward, it seems, in our world. And so are LW using just the initial figures? Are they using the revised, right? You've got this mess with respect to the data itself. Obviously, with the neutral rate of interest in the Wechselian sense, we obviously cannot actually measure the neutral rate of interest, right? Because it's in real terms, so we don't have direct data of this at all. And so, what we're left with, of course, is this veneer of science, where it frees the Federal Reserve officials to pursue their real interest, which is to benefit the federal government politicians in their fiscal excesses and to advance the material interest of the banking elite. So I say, end the Fed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. It reminds me of something Ronald Coase once said: if you torture the data long enough, it will eventually confess. It's a good example of the backflips that mainstream economists do to justify Soviet-style central planning by the Fed. That's essentially what this is about. Now, we at the Mises Institute, we honor scholars every few years with the Peterson Luddy Chair in Austrian Economics. And this is the money was donated for this by Bill Peterson, the late Bill Peterson, and the present Bob Luddy for this. And past holders of this chair were Joe Salerno, Guido Holzman, and Mark Thornton. And our new holder of the Peterson Luddy Chair in Austrian Economics is Jeff Herbener. Jeff has been a senior fellow of the Mises Institute. He's taught at Mises University for decades, like as I have, You're getting old. And he's a prolific scholar, as you can see from his presentation. And he's a great teacher. He's been at Grove City College for many years. Another hood of mine. I grew up 10 miles from Grove City College, my hometown. So, got hoods all over the country. So where's our photographer? Well, we need it. I'm going to come over here, Jeff. I want to present you with this plaque honoring Jeff as the Luddy Peterson Chairholder.